When the landlord showed me the place, the door flopped open on its hinges. Plaster bits and shards of wood littered the short gray carpet. He fumed about the neighborhood kids, using his fingers to form quotation marks around the word kids, and ran it on about how he always asks everyone to lock the outside door, but nobody ever does. He told me the place had been unoccupied for a month, and that the previous occupant had been an English professor at ISU. A couple of months from his retirement, you see, and he needed a place to stay because he needed to work for a few more months, and he'd already sold his house and his wife moved to Ohio. Yeah, the prof, I called him. See, when you called me, I knew that you were going to show up. Just like when the prof left, he called me and told me he cleaned the place up, see? Opening a drawer, sweeping his hand across the narrow expanse of the cramped kitchen to demonstrate that it was, indeed, clean. And I wrote him a check for the damage deposit. Bob's a chunk of a man about 5'8", and the kind of guy who'd be defensive about his stature. It's almost like he's trying to stretch his spine lengthwise as he talks at me. A military man, almost painfully upright despite the increasingly insistent pull of gravity on his aging body. I can see a drill sergeant's features in the now puffy face. Thinning reddish hair and piercing bloodshot azure eyes that never waver. The kind of eye contact designed to intimidate. He's trying to push me around. Cajole me. Shame me in almost into renting his efficiency apartment, and I almost want to tell him he can cease his bullying because I have no choice. No other place to look at. No place that I can afford to pay more for. No time to comparison shop. But that'd rob him of his pleasure. Look, see, these college types are softies. Look at how I suckered him. As he put it, see, I don't enjoy doing this for a living, but I have a knack for it. I'm sanguine about my predetermined choice to sign a 4-month lease, but who am I to rob this slumlord of his tiny flashes of pleasure in his existence of wallowing through the detritus of his constantly shifting list of tenants, 10 years grown short through lack of funds, lost jobs, or simply by tiring from the constant battle to hold back the encroaching roaches? La Casa de Cucarachas, underneath the sink, has reached maximum occupancy. Today, I saw my first live roach crawling across my futon mattress on the floor. Momentary shock was quickly overwhelmed by the knowledge that the black octagonal bug traps standing sentry every 4 feet along all the walls are there for a reason. I stomp on it and kick the carcass across the floor. There will be others. I told myself I knew what I was getting into when I took this job, but now I can't say with any certainty that I did. Terre Haute, literally High Earth or Rare Earth, is one of the most dismal places I've ever visited, and certainly the most deflating place I've lived. Among a list of such illustrious locales as Springfield, Missouri, Carbondale, Illinois, and Bloomington, Illinois. Driving into Terre Haute on Highway 40 evokes that sense of dread that prisoners must experience when passing through the gates of their confining walls. Through West Terre Haute, a collection of ramshackle buildings, capped by the now beat-up house serving as a no-name bar with dollar beer, around the bend toward the Wabash River, suddenly the Vigo County Courthouse towers over you as you cross the murky waters. The courthouse is a massive gray stone building with a central dome that must rise 12 stories or more, white clock faces on all sides, surrounded by a four-poster arrangement of smaller spires. It is unlike any building surrounding it, although the law office across the street attempts to echo its brutal officiousness with four faux Ionian plaster pillars, but only succeeds in creating a comic counterpoint. The very name Vigo inspires a sense of fear and disgust. My imagination creates an image of a prehistoric yet post-industrial ogre, exuding the stench of rotten meat trapped in the crevices of his teeth, musty dried sweat, and the fumes from the paint plant equidistant from the courthouse in my efficiency apartment. Vigo stares down from his perch on high and belches, snorting his derision at those who dare cross his bridge and enter his domain. My neighborhood was once the center of the prostitution business in town, says one of my colleagues in the department. Universally, when I mention the block I live on, I receive nods of recognition slash sympathy slash disgust from whoever is inquiring as to the status of my apartment search, as if to say, "Oh, that's not good," or, "What were you thinking to rent in that part of town?" It's hard to tell, but these same well-meaning colleagues are the same who complained about the lack of high-end rental properties in town, as if I would be able to afford more than the $250 a month I pay monthly for the roach-ridden hole I rent from Bob. Academics compress class difference in the university to assuage their class guilt. These are the same folks that year after year hold their national disciplinary conferences in the $250 per night hotels in New York, Atlanta, Chicago, etc., and then demand that their graduate students shell out student loan money and balloon their credit card debt to attend, while charging up their room service and billing it all, the flight and the ridiculously expensive hotel and the room service and the conference fees to, quote, professional development, end quote, funds reserved for tenure-track faculty, the ones who need the least financial assistance to attend. But to these well-meaning folks, graduate students and adjunct faculty who fail to attend aren't demonstrating a commitment to their scholarship and need to give back to the disciplinary community and need to spend time networking with the scholars in their field. This evinces a blindness to the difference between the remuneration given to adjuncts and graduate students and tenure-track faculty, the labor backbone of the university system that teaches the majority of students and classes. The $10,000 I'll gross this semester pales in comparison to the full professor who complained about the lack of acceptable rentals, and the place I rent won't even resemble the home he owns outside the gritty reality of the neighborhoods that he and I both teach at. But we should both attend the conference because we need to build a sense of community. Those who live in the projects in our academic community see the stratification of it, while those at the top see only a flat surface, homogenized by our common desire to teach and learn, as if that is the great equalizer that erases our fundamental material and subjective differences. Academic conferences are really no more than five-day-long hero worship and personal debasement sessions anyway. Nearly the entire program is composed in the waning hours of the week prior to zero hour, as the frantic looks on the faces of the faculty in the department I did my graduate work in attests to. I don't mean to pick on them specifically, as this behavior can hardly be sequestered there exclusively. It is undoubtedly repeated across the country, across disciplines, across time and space, and all the little academics learn from their heroes and emulate their bizarre rituals. The tenured few, possessors of velveteen regalia and black octagonal beanies, fret the same as MA students at their common deadline, but all the while know that their preceding reputation will ease their task and their presentation. Grad students scramble from panel to panel looking for academic superstars, pens at the ready, left breathless for the mere sight of the giants in their fields of study, left flush from the excitement of hearing their utterances, no matter how derivative and banal, just for the sake of having the sound deciphered by their unwashed ears. None of the stars, nor most of the sycophants, seem to regard this rough parody of Hollywood red carpet line pre-award show runway behavior as unusual or disturbing. They're correct that it isn't unusual, but it should surprise and disturb to think that those with the most searching analytical tools, the critical attention to delve into the minutiae of seemingly common-sense phenomena, could be so willfully blind to the class hierarchy that they've developed, the cults of personality that they've created and carefully nurtured, their cold reliance on the oft-critiqued rubrics of understanding academic success and failure. Hard work, commitment, or the lack of either are the analytical lenses utilized by academics who've already got it made, or are on their way, or so they think. Little do these prospective briar pipe-smoking, suede-patched, tweed-coat-wearing, sagely-stroking chin-whiskers wannabe academics understand about the importance of luck, the intertwined economies of similarity-slash-difference, and status, and class status, and economic position, and privilege will play in their eventual success or failure in academe, just as is true in any other professional endeavor. The importance of privilege in all of its manifestations in describing and predicting the eventual success or failure of folks in all walks of life and professions cannot be overestimated. In the past, analysts have approached the question of privilege by treating it as a manifestation of the disadvantage or advantage accrued by membership in discrete or even fluid identity categories. Male privilege, white privilege, heterosexual privilege, black privilege, Asian privilege. While considerable energies have been devoted by scholars, politicians, and common people to defend privilege or decry it, the fractioning of privilege into identity-based components loses the conceptual clarity and focus necessary to enact a sustained criticism of the edifice of privilege-seeking and denying behaviors and their justifications. For example, focusing attention on white privilege yields fabulous insights into the ways in which whiteness functions as an interpretive strategy, a lens to understand the world and the material advantages accorded to whites as a matter of course by other whites as they move through the world. Whiteness studies offers important insights for how this privilege operates. However, like all critical projects based on identity categories, regardless of how nuanced the understanding of what these categories represent, such criticisms conceal as much as they reveal by locating privilege as part and parcel of the category itself. This is not to accuse whiteness scholars of something so crass as biological essentialism or any other such reductionist nonsense, as the project of exposing and decrying racial privilege in its more nuanced and useful forms forces a recognition that white privilege is really a manifestation of the belief of the powerful that they should remain so, and that they deserve the power that they hold. And it's also a project of convincing the weak that adherence to their conventions of privilege can elevate them from their dispossessed and pathetic state. However, this is not to discount the unique nature of each person's oppression and privilege, as nearly all Americans, at least, possess attributes of both, that constantly interplay inside of their consciousness and manifest outwardly in their relationship to objective reality and the way objective reality treats them. In my high school, where less than 10 black folks attended out of 1,500 students, the nearly complete absence of racial diversity made the question of race less important to the privilege cosmology that developed there, a hierarchy that depended more on class, neighborhood, car, athletic prowess, since racial difference was by a simple number destined to be an exception to the other measures that assumed greater importance. This produced the paradoxical truth that the most downtrodden and oppressed people in this conformity factory were poor white trash. This is certainly not to discount the crushing psychological weight of suppressed and overt racism as it exerted itself on black kids' lives, a weight that I cannot comprehend, let alone weigh. And in the end, the attempt to weigh up oppression and privilege of one group against the monolithic oppression and privilege of others, based solely on membership in an identity category, is a project doomed to failure, or success if you are attempting to prevent the construction and maintenance of cross-racial, cross-gender, cross-religion, and cross-ethnicity, among other crosses, coalitions against privilege and oppression in all of its multivariate forms. Academics seem incapable of understanding this, but they only seem that way. Like all other institutions, and perhaps peculiarly so, the academy depends on identity categories and the project of reifying them as individual and institutional stakeholders battle for funding and recognition from government, colleagues, alumni, and the media, among others. As left criticism infiltrated universities, the desire to instantiate permanent structures and institutions to make safe space for left criticism led to the drive to establish programs and departments that would serve that purpose. Women's studies, black studies, African American studies, GLBTQ studies, Latina and Latino studies, programs and departments were all established with the purpose of establishing a home for scholars and their work that was marginalized by mainstream white academe and continues to be marginalized. However, rather than capitalizing on the growing movement toward left criticism within traditional disciplinary departments, minority scholars pressed for and received their own academic ghettos, which succeeded in providing safe spaces for scholarship considered dangerous, while simultaneously confining their scholarship into places where mainstream and white academics could either safely ignore it or poach from it at will. In other words, academic left critics were forced to assert protection based on identity categories, a trend we know and see continued in the drive for whiteness studies programs where white academics concerned with race attempt to find their own homeland after finding that the safe space for race discussions has been occupied by people of color, and who rightfully see the intrusion of white folks into their departments and programs a drain on their limited resources. For every white student receiving funding from a black studies graduate program, there is one less student of color. For every assistantship in women's studies given to a man, there will be one less woman. Resource constraints lead to the defense of the purity of the identity category from intrusion from its binary other. The flip side of this coin is just as disturbing. Since these programs and departments have come into existence and survived due to their defense of the inviolate nature of identity categories, which started as a creation of safe spaces for academic left criticism, have been colonized by the right again, only this time by the infiltration of rightists who share the identity categories of the departments they join, though not the political orientation. Explicitly anti-feminist women join and subvert women's studies departments. Apologists for privilege join black studies departments. Their qualifications are undeniable. They're black slash woman slash gay, etc., aren't they? Isn't that what this is all about? Isn't that who you serve? The ruse created by academic rightists has now revealed its full circularity, compressed the academic left into minority status, make the only justifiable reason for safe spaces based on identity categories, allow the creation of diverse departments and programs based on those identity categories, reluctantly, ship minority scholars into the new ghettos, enthusiastically, make them fight against and amongst each other for finite resources, gleefully, and then finally use the categorical nature of these programs' justification for dismantling their very reason for existence. The devious circle has closed. Who is the landlord of our academic house? Does it look like a high-end rental, or more like the roach-ridden hole of my experience in Terre Haute? It depends on your position in the academy, but we must be attentive to the importance of standpoint and how each person sees it. Academic classism is no less pernicious than class distinctions elsewhere in society, and people in the academy need to start thinking about our ghettos, our class privilege, and taking action to call out privilege where it lives in our house.